And we've arrived at 23 minutes after the hour, it being a Tuesday. We're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist at Vigneron and a member of the Board of Creation Moments, joins us just about every Tuesday morning, and we discuss things involving science and evolution and faith and creation and the book. Someday, Don, I think we just need to get back into Genesis and just focus on Genesis, because of there are a lot of ways to describe history, but Genesis really is a unique historical account, isn't it?
Oh, it very much is, and you can learn a lot through Genesis. I mean, it's not only the story of the beginnings, but it's mankind's beginnings. Obviously, it's the beginning of the heavens and the earth, as the first verse says, and it takes us through a good part of man's history.
But we tend to look at it looking for scientific information. And I think that's the wrong approach, because I don't think Genesis was ever intended to be science. In fact, I think the notion of scientific method was probably not present with the author of Genesis.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It wasn't present. Of course not. It's the author or the authors, because the... obviously, I mean, Moses wrote it down, but the first parts of Genesis were probably passed down narratively as opposed to in writing.
Generations and generations, generations of storytelling created that, and then before it was ever, pinned to parchment, whatever, however that was first written. But it impresses me. Our story for today, our article, comes from the Institute of Creation Research, and it also contrasts, in a way, evolution and science. And the basic premise here is that evolution, the whole theory, is not as scientific as you might think, because of how real empirical evidence these days. Well, let me go back to the 1980s. There were two great events that taught us a lot, and taught evolutionists, there's got to be a better word for them, evolution proponents, taught them a lesson and gave them indigestion. One was Mount St. Helens, the eruption in 1980, and then two would have been the explosion of the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl in what was then the Soviet Union, 1986, because there are lessons from both those events that kind of turned evolution on its ear, wouldn't you say?
Oh, very much so. I mean, with the Mount St. Helens, you had a certain sequence of plants coming back way sooner than they ever thought, would be possible. Not to mention the quick forming of canyons. Canyons over 100 feet deep formed in one day from a mudslide. Then you had the striations in the canyon, as you see in the Grand Canyon. Of course, the Grand Canyon's a grander scale, but same evidence, and it points to a very, very quick process, a cataclysmic process, as opposed to very slow process of the Colorado River meandering through the Grand Canyon, forming the canyon, as the story goes.
This whole notion of geologic time was put to the test there with Mount St. Helens, but that was not a nuclear explosion. Although it may have had the force of a nuclear blast, it didn't leave a residue of radiation that was predicted to be destroying life for generations to come. The radiation part of it. And apparently there's some things going on in the Chernobyl area that are opening some eyes in terms of the survivability of both plant and animal life.
Well, there is, and just to kind of recap, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant overheated in April 26, 1986, and it exploded. And that obviously caused intense radiation. And several workers, dozen workers or so, got not only sick, but it sickened thousands of people that were around that area. And the entire city of Chernobyl was evacuated. And because of the intense radiation, the intense radiation will last for centuries. in about a thousand square mile. So there's a 1,000 square mile exclusion zone around the reactor. Now, the interesting thing is you say, well, okay, this is obviously detrimental to man. So the conclusion is it's got to be detrimental to animals and it's got to be detrimental to plants. So it should have wiped out all plants and all animal life in that area. And there shouldn't be any, I mean, it should be sterile. You know, there shouldn't be anything around. But that's not the case. There are many, many plants that survived, that did not die, but actually not only survived, but are thriving in the area. There are other plants that are coming back very, very quickly, and there are animals. They say that there's wolves, there's boars, there's bears are returning to the lush forest around the old nuclear plant. It's like, okay, don't these guys know that there's radiation there and that's going to damage you and hurt you and make you sick? And it's like, no, we don't know that because we're somehow protected. And so, of course, the evolutionists look at this and they say, aha, we got evidence of evolution taking place. Because all of this radiation is going to cause all of these mutations in their system, and this is happening so fast, it's amazing. But when you actually look and see, what you find is that these plants, for example, have a protective mechanism that only appears when there's an exposure to radiation. And the protective mechanism is, okay, you know, we got to talk about DNA. So the DNA is where all the damage can occur, you know, through radiation. And if your DNA gets damaged, then the organism's going to pass on errors, if you will, you know, to the next generation, which may in most likely not be very beneficial to the organism. However, these plants that they've looked at, at least one plant that they've looked at, it is just the opposite. The plant turned on, apparently, didn't, of course, the author says it evolved, but it turned on a system that gave the plant ultra protection against evolution.
Well, so you said the magic word. You said look and see. That would be the scientific part of it. Look and see and analyze and report what the facts are. And what you're describing is not an evolutionary process where generations and generations and thousands of generations were necessary to mutate. Is that the right word? To mutate DNA. But it was a built-in mechanism that the plants had from the beginning.
Well, it appears that way, and as a matter of fact, if you look at the mutation rate in these plants that have been exposed to the radiation, the mutation rate is far less after exposure to the radiation than before, which also goes contrary to evolution, because evolution says you need mutations in order, you need these errors to come in. And after so many thousands and, you know, of errors, then you might get something positive out of it, and you might get, you know, a new species or whatever.
Trial and error, so, in other words.
Yeah. So evolutionary theory is based on a trial and error basis, whereas, of course, you know, if you believe in God creation and that God designed into systems, into organisms, the ability to adapt very, very quickly to their environment, and genes get turned on due to environmental stimuli, in this case it would be radiation, that normally aren't on to the degree that, you know, they are after the exposure, then the design is already there. It doesn't see, you haven't created new information what has happened is you've turned on a gene or multiple genes weren't normally turned on, and therefore, you know, these genes, then these proteins, might cause an added layer of protection around the DNA. There might be additional enzymes that come along and say, aha, there's an error, and clip it out, and then replace it with the proper code for that particular section. Anyway, that appears to be what's happening here with these plants, and they only looked at one plant so far, but it may be that the animals that are roaming in this area and thriving in this area also have a similar mechanism built into them so that they are less susceptible to the radiation than one would have thought initially.
Well, what you're describing here is a difference between trial and error and then kind of an engineered, trial and error is like happenstance. Just like through generations, there are incremental changes in genes. Most of them are wasted and result in death. But some of them go on to, in the evolutionist view, to change the creature, whether it's a plant or an animal, into something that can survive or thrive in a different environment, as opposed to an engineering approach, which is a manipulation of elements to a given end. In other words, it's considered. It's the path from beginning to end is designed.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. It's not in the article, but it's one I thought of when I was reading the article. Okay, take a modern car, for example, especially the cars that have all of these sensors around them and can sense when something is near it. A couple of years ago, when I went up to a Creation Moments board meeting, I rented a car, and this car had the ability to sense the distance between the car in front of you. And so regardless of, how hard I pressed on the acceleration on the pedal, if the car in front of me was going, 65 miles an hour, or let's say, in a 70 or 75 mile an hour speed zone, I was only going 65 miles an hour. And it took me a while to figure out, hey, what's the deal?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I pulled over to the other lane where there's no cars, and then I could accelerate. And I said, oh, okay, but it's got a sensor. It's got a distance sensor in it that was purposely designed to protect me. Right? So think of these plants as having these sensors in them that's specifically designed to protect the plant in case of an environmental catastrophe like we had in Chernobyl. And so that had to be put there from the very beginning. if you looked deep enough and hard enough in the DNA, and you could, analyze the whole genome and figure out what every protein, all the coding was for, you could look at this design and say, wow, this is really, really amazing. And we don't know what other designs are in these organisms, in us even, to help protect us from, a negative environment.
Well, I suspect you're grateful that distance sensing system was designed by engineers and not evolutionists. Because their slogan would be, well, back to the drawing board.
Yeah, try it and see. If it works, then you won't hit the person in front of you.
Oops, sorry, Don. Next.
let's try something else. Well, and of course, in the engineering world, it's a discipline. It comes out of science. It comes out of basic research, for example. And then through our creative mind, by the way. It's like, I think we're going to put a sensor and have a mechanism. We got to tie it in with the acceleration system and the speed, so that we've got to, you got to put a computer in there in order to read the sensor, constantly reading the sensors, right? And then the computer is analyzing and saying, oh, nope, you can't go any faster than this. And and then regardless of what the operator is doing, we've got to override that. It's like, you know, it's the autopilot in an airplane, for example. And of course, you know, they're trying to design cars to be autopilot so you don't have to drive it. And you just put it on autopilot and it takes care of itself. So that clearly is design. But yet when we come to biology and we see far more sophisticated design in biology, we say, oh, well, it just evolved very quickly. That's surprising. Instead of saying, wow, what a wonderful designer. I mean, I may not know the designer, but this has to be designed because it is so complicated and fantastic that instead of, you know, giving the glory to an inanimate concept of evolution, we should be giving the glory to God that, hey, this is design, so there must be a designer, and the designer, as we know it from Genesis, is our creator God.
And I would remind you that last week we were talking about the difference between DNA coding and computer coding, and have learned that computer code I'm losing. Have we lost your audio, Don?
I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can. Something went wrong there for a second, and there was a delay between the audio and the video. So at any rate, that we learned that DNA coding was many times more complicated than computer coding. Although the comparison is interesting, I'm not sure it's real relevant either, because whoever designed that DNA code has got a leg up on all of us.
Well, he does. I mean, the DNA code is far more sophisticated than anything that we have ever designed yet. If we've taken all the design features in everything that man has designed, it doesn't even come close to the design of the DNA or the mechanisms within a cell in order to utilize the information. It's like, you know, you can have a computer, you can have a computer hard drive, or you know, now it's all memory chips that contain all of this information, all of this code. But if the computer doesn't do anything with it, doesn't have the rest of the interface to do something with the information, it's not useful. So all of the mechanisms within the cell, in order to take the information from the DNA, convert it into RNA, which then converts into proteins, both structural proteins or enzymes or other, you know, types of things, then the information is useless. But all of this is coded within the DNA, and of course the cell itself has the rest of the mechanism, if you will, for putting it all to use.
Hmm. Now, I'm kind of reading through this article again, and the evolution proponent who's discussing this says, well, this is all because radiation levels early in the Earth were much higher, and that's what created this ability of plants to adjust. So in essence, he's conceding that the plants have an innate ability to fix themselves. What he refuses to do is to credit an engineer, a designer.
Well, right, because he's got to stick to his, stick to his guns there, if you will, with regard to the evolutionary story. So it didn't happen at Chernobyl; it happened in the early part of life, when life was trying to figure out itself. That's when all of this information was added, because of course there was more radiation at the beginning.
Let me read this part of the article to you, because it's revealing, and it begins. So when did all of the necessary evolutionary tinkering to produce radiation resistant systems happen? With undaunted faith in an evolutionary theory impervious to facts, this is Thompson, who's the scientist that was reporting this on public broadcasting. Thompson mentally buries the inconsistency by claiming that, quoting Thompson now, levels of natural radiation on the Earth's surface were much higher in the distant past when early plants were evolving. So plants in the exclusion zone may be drawing upon adaptations dating back to this time in order to survive. He has to assume that evolution was true in order to explain evolution.
In order to explain this particular mechanism, he's got to, he's so stuck, and you'll find this. The folks that are really locked in on evolution, they just push it back. I mean, when there's evidence that says, okay, this couldn't possibly have evolved in this short period of time now, then they have to push it back to a further time. Or it's just like, well, where did all this stuff come from? Well, it couldn't have possibly have come from the Earth, because there's just not enough time for all of this, all these organisms to evolve. So it had to come from outer space.
Hmm.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yes. So sometime in outer space, all of this evolutionary took place. So we take it off of the Earth and we put it on to some mysterious other planet that we haven't found yet, where all of the evolution took place. And so this is what he's doing. He's just pushing it back a little bit further. So saying, well, it obviously had to evolve because the system is there. We can see that it's there and the mechanisms are there. But I believe so much in evolution. I believe. So therefore, I've got to blame it on evolution as opposed to saying, hey, this is designed by our creator.
Strikes me that evolution itself has become a faith system.
Oh, very much so. You either, environmental, or it's the materialistic faith system, that there can't possibly be any spiritual component here, but we believe it so much that it turns into a religion for us.
Hmm. Indeed. Dr. Don Clark is a biochemist and, again, member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to mention their website to you, because you find that Creation Moments is an incredible resource for scientific information that supports the biblical story of creation. And it's at creationmoments.com is where you can find them. You can link to them from our website. And, Don, I appreciate the time you give us every Tuesday. It's fascinating, and we're learning a bunch. And we thank you. Wish you a good week. We'll see you next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay. See you, Don.